Welcome to the Reformist Pipeline. TRP is the CEO of Education Podcast, and we are here with your dose of empowerment and the pipeline to inform your decisions on how you can support change in our education system. My name is Lindsay, affectionately known as Miss Black.
And I'm Hottie High. Can I do it?
Oh!
Mr. Russo, if you're feeling... I'm feeling I See You by Coco Jones today, Lynn. Hopefully you've been vibing with that song like I have recently.
Ooh, why would you put me on the spot? Okay, I don't listen to Coco Jones. See, this is why we need to start scripting stuff for real. We can't do this wicked stuff no more. It is nothing personal by any means. Oh my God, they're gonna kill me for this. I watch, what's the show?
I don't know the show. Okay.
I don't know the show. I know Coco Jones because of Bel-Air.
Okay.
And I'm one of those people that has a hard time adjusting to somebody's multiple talent. It's the stupidest thing ever. So please bash me if you want. But seeing somebody on TV and then I'm not inspired to listen to their music. Now, okay. But wait. I hadn't listened to it. It's not that like I'm watching her on TV and I'm like, oh, I don't want to listen. I've heard the music. I don't want to listen to it because she's on TV.
Right.
I'm watching her on TV. I put her in this category in my head. I don't need to go like do more research to listen. But I did hear a song or I saw a clip of her singing. I'm like, ooh, mommy.
Yes. It's good. It's good stuff. Okay. Hey, but you know me. I am like all things R&B. So like that's just what happens. So like she does it. She does it for me. And I can't wait to see how big of a career she has. I feel like she's gonna take off even further than she already is. So yeah, love it. But what's been going on with you, Lynn?
Well, okay. So this is when this episode drops, we will be, I think, like probably a week out from the actual event that was the most exciting thing that's ever happened to me this weekend.
What was that?
Not ever, but the LSU in Iowa game, NCAA basketball. I used to play basketball. I played all the way up and through college. I'll stop doing that. I played for the Howard University club team, 1867, 18 claps for my people that get it. The ones that don't, it's okay. But, like, it was a very different experience, like, playing at Howard. Like, I'm playing on an all-black team, black coach, and we were traveling. So, it wasn't we were just intramural playing other teams on campus. Like, some weekends we were going to Georgia. Some weekends I went to Boston. It was freezing. But we're playing other AAU teams. It's like AAU teams.
I get what you're saying, though.
College teams. I don't want people to think that, like, we was playing 5-on-5 with other people from Howard. Like, because people
right.
But I really enjoyed the game. I knew LSU was gonna win, and at the end of the day, I am, but you know, rooting for everyone black. That's just what I'm gonna do. I felt very strongly, and I felt really like affirmed when Reese did this, the "You Can't See Me" thing. And people referenced it as taunting Caitlin at the end of the game. Caitlin Clark, who is a phenomenal player.
Yes, she is. She was getting it.
Okay. I love people, but I love a player that can do what they want. Like, she can really do whatever she wants. Like, period. She's going to go hella far for that. However, I don't like the narrative that's being spun on my bro Reese.
Right.
For doing this, because when Clark did it, it wasn't a problem.
Nobody was talking about it at all.
It was cool that she did it.
Yeah.
Right. And then when they played South Carolina in the Final Four game, she did not guard the player. Like, she just waved her off. And now, like, don't get me wrong. I understand, like, watching tape of the other team, right? You're really studying, you know your personnel. There's people that I don't have to close out hard on her because she's not a three-point shooter. I do need to give her a little bit of space because she might drive right past me. I understand personnel. I get that.
Exactly.
But like the waving her off like, oh, like this is beneath me. I don't even need to do that.
Disrespectful.
That was
disrespectful. Rude.
Here's the thing. Let's just all be disrespectful if it's just about the game. So like, you can do this and you can wave her off. I don't understand why Reese can't do this. Because let's be fucking for real. She getting that ring.
Yes, she is.
She's getting that ring.
Yeah.
So, I also don't like that I went to the gym today and like they're talking about it. Like there was a white news anchor asking the black news anchor, like, you know, his thoughts on it. And the dude was just like, they're playing basketball. Like, that's just the name of the game. Like,
absolutely.
She won. At the end of the day, she won against a phenomenal player. Also, I'm going into my basketball history right now. But take Jeremy Lin. Take Jeremy Lin, for example, and like the Lin Sanity movement, okay? Jeremy Lin also went to my high school, and he.
Okay.
I really thought his little brother was maybe nicer than him, but he was a smaller frame, but that's another conversation. But. When Jeremy Lin finally got his chance when he played with the Knicks, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was on the street. They just thought, oh, he got the Asian boy got lucky the first time. Asian boy got lucky the second time. Jeremy Lin scored points against Kobe Bryant. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Jeremy Lin was still in there, like, yeah. Like, he still has respect for Kobe. But
right.
Kobe also Kobe before the game was like, I'm cool. I'm not worried about him. But Jeremy came down there and handed it to them, right? And at that point, like, all of, like, the, like, Asian Americans were finally like, oh, my God, there's representation for me. Like, we can't.
Exactly.
Like, it just means something so much bigger, right?
Yeah.
And so I just felt a type of way because Reese can absolutely be excited that she played on a team and played in a game where she beats a team that had probably the most phenomenal NCAA women's basketball player to date in it. So talk that talk, baby.
That's exactly what I was saying. That's exactly what I said. I loved it. I was looking for every second of it. I couldn't wait for LSU to win. I was excited. It just was like, hey, I'm glad that Women's March Madness is getting the visibility that it deserves. And that's what I also was super excited and proud about. So, and I think that it's going to be crazy to see Reese and Caitlin Clark go back at it once they get to the WNBA, if that's what they end up wanting to do. So I feel like that's what this is about, right? It's like creating that rivalry. It happens. Like, it happens. It's organic. Like, I'm excited. So,
Leave Reese alone. And I will say, like, I went to predominantly white high school, and that's where I played basketball, and we were one of the most diverse teams in the entire league. It was, like, four black girls starting. We had two, they looked a little biracial. One of them was biracial. Two, like, six-footers. We had a Polynesian girl. We had an Asian girl. We were, like, a diverse team. And when we played our white counterparts and our Asian counterparts, we was called thugs. Y'all are sitting moms in the stands calling 15 and 16 year old girls. I was a little girl. Let's be fucking for real. Calling us thugs. Okay. And at other schools yelling out nigger. Excuse my language for people that are offended from the stands as we're at the free throw line. Like, our coach literally had to say something to these people. And like being seen this way, like, I'm just here to play basketball. Look, I just came to dance and that's it. Like,
right.
I just came to play.
That's
and
real.
You guys are upset about my physicality and also attaching it to my race, which makes you think that it's appropriate to use the microaggression of thugs. Because the white girls did it because they knew how we was coming. It wasn't a problem. It wasn't a problem when she kicked my teammate when she was on the ground. So I just felt very strongly about Reese, and I'm glad Reese is going in it with a like, look, y'all gonna say what y'all gonna say anyway, so I'm gonna do me, and at the end of the day, I'm a winner.
Love it. The end. And, you know, this is the perfect segue for this amazing episode that y'all are about to get to listen to. I'm not going to spoil it too much, but we have a guest coming on, and I want you to continue to listen. I'm not going to do no intro or nothing because I want you to continue. If you got to fast forward, go ahead and do your part. But we're excited to go. We're going to be, as you know, we talked about critical race theory, and there's just so much to talk about. So we even try to figure out, like, how we can have more conversations about this. But please listen to the whole thing. Please comment. Please give us all your feedback. We're super excited for y'all to take a listen to this. And more importantly, don't forget to subscribe to the Patreon. And with that, we love y'all. And go ahead, tune in.
All right, we are now transitioning into our meat of the episode concept development. And we are going to begin by talking about our first taboo topic of the season. Yes, which is my favorite and yours. And this is total sarcasm. I'm sure everyone has differing opinions about this topic. You might hear a lot about it rooting in Florida and all those issues, and we'll get into that. But we are going to discuss critical race theory. We might shorten it and say CRT, just know that we're talking about the same thing. And we have a lovely guest here today, super knowledgeable. I'm very excited to have Isaac here. So if you'd like to just quickly introduce yourself, and then we can jump into the conversation.
Sure. Well, thank y'all for having me. I'm Isaac Edveshinoy. I am a avid documentary watcher and a professional wrestling fan. I am, yes, we can explore that later.
Okay, I was going to jump in. I don't want
to
throw you.
I grew up in the Washington metropolitan area. And so I spent most of my life here, but spent some time away for college at the University of Virginia and at George Washington University. And I work as a director of diversity, equity, and inclusion at a medical research organization. So I am really excited to just kind of dive into this and talk just a little more about the connections to education from my standpoint.
I love it. Was the last documentary you watched about critical race theory?
The 1619 Project, that was the last one.
Oh, that's so crazy. I didn't think you were going to say that. All right. Okay. Well, smooth transition. Let's just level the playing field so everybody knows what we're talking about when we say critical race theory. So what is critical race theory?
Yeah, so that's always a great place for us to start. So critical race theory is... it emerged out of a framework for legal analysis in the late 70s. It is born of both critical legal studies and radical feminism, which is really both just giving a way to kind of analyze the law and figure out how race, racism, and power are embedded in our legal systems and policies. So what has happened now is that people have confused the term critical race theory, which has been taught as a way to analyze and understand the law, which means for the most part, the teaching of it has been occurring in law schools with fully formed human, adults, we would hope fully formed.
Yeah, right.
And so, so what a lot of people are referring to as critical race theory is not actually that. So, critical race theory is different from culturally responsive teaching, which is where we are adapting our teaching approaches to reflect the backgrounds that are presented and showing up in the classroom. And it's different from a robust and exhaustive exploration of American history, which is us just taking a moment to acknowledge that things happened and understanding how those things happen, why those things happen, and how those things are impacting the reality that we're living today. So it's helpful to define because there's just a lot of misinformation and confusion about what exactly we're talking about when we talk about critical race theory.
I am processing.
Yeah. No, that definitely is good. And you know, I'm glad that you broke it down in that way. First and foremost, breaking down and speaking to critical race theory. And then secondly, talking about culturally responsive teaching and naming that they're different and naming more importantly that this is American history and saying that these are not things that we're going and creating and inventing. It's more so that these are things that probably have been taught in 40 years. And now we're just doing a better job of having more consistent conversations around them. So thank you so much for that. And now I would love to know, as far as the existence of it in education, what have you heard? What are ways people are kind of pushing back and are like, absolutely not? what's going on in that landscape?
Yeah, thanks for that. So what if we were critical race theory as a framework would empower us to look at education as a system and to understand the ways in which race, racism, and power are baked into our creation of that system. So when people are saying that they're applying critical race theory to education, what they are talking about is looking at things like the impact of policies such as redlining and how that shaped where people could live and therefore shaped the types of school experiences that people had, which shaped the types of policy that governed the school and how students were engaged in the school. And so when we're thinking about critical race theory in education, we are looking at the system and how the system is built, how our policies are built. So how things like discipline and, you know, accountability and metrics for success and performance. And are there some racial biases that we are carrying when it comes to those systems that are then causing racism to persist? This is different. So what is actually happening in schools is that people are looking at it as us trying to dictate what parts of our history we teachers can teach in the classroom. And that's something different. That is actually creating a spirit and a vibe around censorship as opposed to it is being masked as creating a space for non-discrimination. Like we want to create a space where everybody isn't feeling guilty or everybody isn't feeling like they, So it's given, it's being worded as a non-discrimination corrective action when it actually is censorship. And so when you're like banning books and you're banning training on being an inclusive person, like if you're banning all of those things, then you're really creating unsafe spaces. And the example that I saw that was being highlighted in Florida, which I felt was helpful to bring up, is like, for example, we have workplaces are required to have some training around harassment, right? But if we're not actually talking about oppression and how power can create relationships and how power is distributed or your proximity to power is distributed based on your identity, well, then it's hard for us to then have a conversation around the ways that you might abuse that power. And so the line is so blurry and we have given, particularly in Florida, we've given parents and students the agency to sue school districts based on what, and those types of things are just so exhausting to our legal system. And you know, we're putting, and not to, and I'm not trying to make an assumption that people are not highly educated on this topic, but the reality is they aren't, because we're referring to CRT as something.
Right.
So, so putting that type of agency in the hands of folks that don't really understand the issue is, I mean, that's in part, I guess, how we've gotten here. But that is just creating an environment that is very dangerous, particularly to people who have marginalized identities. So, you know, there's just that. That's all.
You know, minor things, minor things.
That's it.
Yeah, I'm finding it just very interesting. You know, race and racism really bothers the whites, okay, and the white adjacents. Like, I mean, people think that acknowledging race or saying Black is racist. And so I've been trying to like re-gauge, like be more, cognizant of like how the white people, especially in my company, are perceiving this conversation. Cause I work for a curriculum company. Mm-hmm. And so we have had issues with our humanities piece because they're like, this is CRT. And so I've been trying to shift towards, like, our response is, this is history. And these are the values that, you know, America was founded on. And we're just going to make sure that we are also discussing the times in history where we did not live up to our values. And these are their words, not mine, because I might have different words. But I've been trying to shift the conversation to that piece about power, because I'm like, okay, if I say race or black, y'all can't hear me. But you understand the power dynamic. Like, you understand that. And I've been having, like, offshoot conversations with, like, black women, and them, like, in their companies, trying to make these conversations, like, not binary, not black or white. Let's talk about the, like you said, going back to seeing education as a system and talking about the systems. So I'm glad that you highlighted the pieces about systems and about power, because I feel like, especially being black, I feel like I'm like hitting my head like into a wall, having the same conversations as like a black woman and saying the same thing. So I'm like, okay, well, how can I switch this up so that the people that are non-black can actually hear me? And so I just wonder where I would be if I was in the school right now in the same environment.
Yeah. And you know, when you said that, like, there was something core there that I try to lean into to help me have some of these conversations and they not be as frustrating or exhausting. And that really is around, well, what are our shared values? Like, could we all actually agree that these are the types of experiences that a person should have, or the types of opportunities that a person should have access to? And usually, especially in education, I feel like that has pushed that helps to push the conversation further, because we really have to, in order to have conversations about what we would like about student outcomes, we have to be in agreement around, like, who we are and what type of world we actually want to be in. And, you know, I think that there is an assumption that we are all on the same page about that. And we are, and we are not on the same page about that. Mm-hmm. And what people understand as success and what it means to live a life looks very different based on the opportunities that you have historically been given and the opportunities that you see people around you have. And so, so I think makes the conversation particularly interesting and particularly real for folks. Power, I always mention power because ultimately that's what privilege gets you. It gets you proximity to power. But even folks who have proximity to power don't believe that is not an argument. The fact that you have proximity to power and I do not, that is not an argument that compels many people to act, because people will not acknowledge the ways. There's always an assumption that I did something that kept me from being close to power, when actually my very existence, I was born into a situation where the route of power and my access to power was preordained prior to me arriving here. And so that's a really hard thing for people to sit with, because we are, the cornerstone of our American ideal is the fact that we lifted ourselves up. If you want to be it, you can do it. And all you need to do is work hard. And we have generations of folks that look like us who have been working hard since they were brought here. Or in my situation, since my family immigrated here. Either way, they have been the hardest working folks I have ever encountered. And still, it was very hit or miss. It could have literally taken one wrong turn for my life to look completely different.
Yeah. Come on.
Oh, yeah. That's so good. Also, shout out to the ancestors, because they really did it. Like, they really kept going, and they at least they were able to put folks on a path so that we could like be on a podcast. You know what I mean? Yeah. Talking about it with some freedom.
Yeah.
So sorry, I feel like I went on a tangent, but I'll hopefully. But the value piece,
you were right there.
I think is the key part to opening the conversation to folks.
And you know, I think that that's why when you were speaking to guilt earlier, I think I would love for us to have a quick tidbit about student outcomes, because I think that there is a true fear that white children are going to feel this enormous amount of guilt when they're learning about slavery, when they're learning about different Black legends and different Black people that have done great work. And so I think what's really bothered me is the absence of understanding that these feelings that these white children are about to start experiencing, quote unquote, for the first time, that's what we've been doing. Like, that is what has made us resilient. Yeah. So why are they absolved from that experience? And we have to endure that type of upbringing.
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, the guilt has been kind of brought up. It's been mentioned a lot. Like, we don't want people to feel bad. And the reality is, if we had more conversation more often and earlier, people wouldn't feel bad. So I think about, think about this. I was thinking about this as I was thinking about our talk today. Men, our society has been fashioned to get men to power quickly. Like, it's just built to get men there. If you don't have conversation with men about what a appropriate use of that power looks like, you get abused. Abuse causes trauma. Trauma gets passed down. If we're not having conversation with folks about the effective use of power, and if we're not using history to show people, here are many times where power was not used well, and this is the result of that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you don't do that, if we don't create scenarios and spaces where we can have conversations like that, we will continue to create trauma for people. And if we are continuing to create trauma, we're not all going to be here very long. So it's, you know, it's not necessarily a conversation that's designed to make people feel guilty. It's actually designed so that all of these advancements that we've made in civil rights, people understand why we need to protect those things in order to protect people.
Mm-hmm.
So critical race theory actually came about because scholars in that time saw we were getting all this legislation passed in the 60s between the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. We were getting all these things passed. But by the time we got to the late 70s, lots of those things were starting to be rolled back. Mm-hmm. Does that sound familiar to what's happening now?
Yeah.
And so the question was, well, if we fixed these things in the law, why are we backtracking now?
Mm-hmm.
And it's because we made the assumption that making that one fix was going to change it. But really, when we built all of these systems around this reality, we just have a whole lot more work to do. And I'm not actually in the business of making anybody feel bad for the circumstances that we are in. I'm just trying to make sure that people understand that you have a responsibility to change these systems because of the power that you have. And you should, because I can't change it.
I can't do it, big dog.
I can raise awareness for why it needs to change, but the folks that are in positions of power that can change it don't have the same identity that I do. So we have to call those folks in. It's not really about guilt so much as it's just like, this is actually a reality.
Yeah.
Like, it's actually a reality that white homes have 10 times more wealth than Black homes do. That is a reality.
And that's what really gets me about it, is that there is like, I'm not winging it, baby. Like, there's literal data. And that's another thing that really bothers me about, like, being Black, Indigenous, or a person of color in these predominantly white spaces and trying to, like, advocate for these things on your personal behalf, your community, or another community. It's just like, I have to, because of white supremacist tenets, I have to come with all the data. I have to come with all the notes. I have to come, oh, it's research-based. And even when I come with that, y'all still are like, well, no, it's making me feel bad. And then on the other piece, there's such a strong push for social emotional learning, especially after the pandemic. And I feel like we're sending the wrong message in counteracting what social emotional learning really should be. We shouldn't be labeling feelings as bad and labeling feelings as good. Like, we can, but the second layer would be to know that if you want to label them bad or good, that's fine, but there's going to be a balance. You're going to see one more, you're going to see the other more. And we're teaching kids to not feel guilt or to not feel shame or not feel bad, exactly, or to not want to cry when we take away these like opportunities. Because at the end of the day, people are able to grapple with things on a less personal level when they're external or they're outside of them. Like, you might be able to relate to it, but it's still like outside of you. And so I'm like, we're setting these kids back if we cannot talk about literally something that happened 40 years ago or 100 years ago before these kids were even born. And feelings might come up, but that's when we just have the opportunity to talk about them. Because like you said, it's going to be a never-ending cycle. Because then, you know, people stop giving a fuck about kids after middle school, if you ask me. They no longer kids, or especially high school, and now they're just adults, and all of a sudden we don't really care about anymore. But now they're adults who can't handle guilt, who can't handle shame. And now, like you said, they're in these positions of power because we won't just catch it early while they're stupid. Mm-hmm.
And they've taken all that resentment with them. And the challenging, what I love about what you said, which is actually really important, is that if we have a fear of students feeling guilty, perhaps we need to design a curriculum that teaches them how to also cope with guilt. Like, and so, and so that's, you know, that's when we've been having conversations around DEI, and it seems like organizations are not wanting to act. The interesting question that I've been asking is, well, what are we afraid of? You know? Because we actually need to embrace that. But even on an individual level, like Toni Morrison is the one. She is the icon. And the one thing that she said in an interview that I think about all the time is what everybody has to think about when it comes to privilege. But she was talking very specifically about whiteness. And she said, who are you without that? Do you like yourself? Do you like the person that you see in the mirror? And that's like, when we talk about things on the individual level, that's how deep we have to go. Like, are you situated as a person in this world? And how are you positioning yourself to understand other people's personhood if it's different from yours? And if you haven't been given the strategies, because they're not particularly taught in schools, if you haven't given the strategies to cope with when that different experience makes you uncomfortable about your own, that's a personal issue. That's something that you have to go work on. Like, sit in that and think about that and work on that, right? So, you know, that's why there's such danger in how these policies are coming about, because we're not actually dealing with the core issue. We just are trying to curate spaces where nobody feels uncomfortable. And nothing gets done in an experience where nobody feels uncomfortable.
There's like nothing.
No customer service operation in the world is what it is because we get customer service right. We have to awful experiences. Like, I have to be on the phone with Verizon for 4 hours for me to be incensed. Because what am I going to do? I'm going to go to Verizon and be like, y'all need to get this shit together.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Because I don't want to feel like I felt that day. But I also have to sit. So I will do that. But I also have to sit with myself and be like, "Sir, why did Verizon make you so upset? I got to look in the mirror."
Yeah, you do.
You know. So it's like it's everybody's responsibility. It's not just the responsibility of the system, and we are legislating as such.
Yeah, I would agree. And speaking with this, this everybody concept and trying to like to show to people that critical race theory is not a black or white thing. Can you speak to the other components of critical race theory? I've heard of like critical Latino theory or how critical race theory like seeps in or influences these attacks on the LGBTQIA community or all that realm.
Yeah, so critical race theory as a tradition, as we said, focuses on race, racism, and power. We have had offshoots of that that have focused on specific racialized identities and their experiences and relationships to the law. For example, with LatCrit, so with critical Latin theory, that tradition is actually exploring lots of things related to immigration, use of language in the law, and issues that may impact communities that are affiliated with that identity. So you'll see that when we talk about LGBTQ plus and using that as a lens, you'll see a focus on all of the things that we're seeing now just around the legislation of gender and of women and women's bodies and all of these and healthcare and these anti-trans, those types of things. You know, there's a focus on that and trying to figure out how you dismantle those systems that continue to oppress those groups. After 9/11, we saw that there was a focus particularly with Muslims, people who had Muslim identity and Arab identity, because of the ways that the law was weaponized against them in retaliation to what we saw with the 9/11 attacks. And for our indigenous population, the ways in which, you know, we use that tradition or the framework to really explore land and how land has been leveraged and legislated, how access to resources has been. And so there are just so many. Race is a social construct, as we know. We created it, we made it up, and we decided this was going to be one of the cornerstones of our existence.
Right.
And then we got upset, and then we get so uncomfortable when it gets brought up. And I'm just like, but I didn't create it. And most of the time, I'm not going to. So I say all that to say that depending on, we have some identity-based and some really focused work that happens because we realize that not every racial identity is experiencing the world in the same way. And so some issues are much, you know, some issues are more important to follow up on, you know, as opposed to others. So that's where, you know, but it's helpful at least for all of those communities to be in conversation and collaboration with each other, because those types of things actually have dramatic impact across all of those identities. So, for example, the lots of things that were happening legislatively around surveillance that happened after 9/11 are the same types of tactics that were used to surveil Martin Luther King and surveil the Black Panthers. And so all of these it's, you know, all of these things have a connection to each other.
Yeah.
And so it's important at least to honor that and to be very mindful and vigilant about this concept that we're rising all boats. So, you know, that's why Black Lives Matter became such a divisive tool But the core part of it is that what was being said was that if we valued Black lives, we would actually value bias.
The end.
That's it.
That's all I'm saying. That's all.
Yeah, that's all. It's not saying that these lives are more important than other lives. It's not saying any of that. It's saying that based on how we built this system to particularly criminalize and murder these bodies, if we address that, everybody actually would be safer.
Literally.
it's important at least for us to focus some of those efforts because different identities have different needs, but it's important for us to really see the connection and the intersections between them all. So I love it. That's what makes it so interesting. And that's what makes it so important because these new challenges are really popping up all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfortunate, but we're just in an age right now where the word race is being weaponized against the communities who have been historically excluded because of race. So
where's the hope, Isaac? where's the hope?
And give us something, please.
Listen, where I draw a lot of hope is that the world, we are learning a lot about the world right now, but the world is better than it was last year. It doesn't seem like it, but it is actually better.
Because, no one has ever said that.
It doesn't, but
before.
It's actually better because people actually frame it as we're rolling back or we're actually getting. But the difference now is that we have people who are mobilized in every place to fight.
Yeah.
Nobody in 10, 15 years ago, no one would have ever imagined that Georgia would have gone blue.
Mm-hmm.
No one would have ever thought that that could be a thing.
Okay.
But it happened. It's true. Okay. It happened. No one would have ever thought that we're having national conversations about drag shows, y'all. National conversation.
Better work.
In my childhood, the only time that I ever saw anyone that presented that way was on New York Undercover or Law & Order SVU, and they were being murdered within the first 5 minutes. So we're having different types of conversations. People have different access to information. And so you can't. Yeah, so that's where I have the most hope because that is slowly building activists and people who are just asking questions in ways that are different from how we have historically done it. So there are folks who are, will get things together and go march down Pennsylvania Avenue, and they're cool with that, and I feel great about that. And I know that I have different agency to go and work with a nonprofit that needs money to mobilize those people. You know, I am getting an ad a day. The Democratic Party in particular is really doing it. They're doing a lot because I'm getting a text a day about a race in Wisconsin that I need to support, a race in New York I need to support, a race in Arizona that I need to support. That type of the ways in which I, as a person, am now a citizen of the United States and not just a citizen of this place right here, that makes me hopeful. Because that's why we're talking about what's happening in Florida. We wouldn't be having conversations. We were never having conversations really about local policy like we do now. All of that actually makes me very hopeful because the flip side of that is that in our communities where we are actually able to change things, we're able to share those learnings quickly. If somebody has an idea to build a school that is the cornerstone that leverages culturally responsive teaching as a cornerstone and is doing that well, We are in a system now where that school cannot stay a secret. We got to know about that thing so we can spread it. And we are spreading it. And so, you know, for better or for worse, those grassroots approaches really are working. And we realize that we can't rely on the federal level alone. We actually have to be invested in who's on the school board here. Like, who is, I need to know who it is. And that makes me very hopeful because this generation that is coming has really had it with our older generations. Like, they had it. They're just like, this isn't working, and I don't know why we're keeping it this way. And so now I got to get in the system and figure out how to do it. And I'm just so hopeful for them, and I'm so hopeful for us because our collective understanding is just growing really quickly. That was a lot. Sorry.
Yeah.
Just 5 minutes to answer my question.
That was good. That was good.
That's why I get out of the bed. Because otherwise you would just be in the bed. Otherwise you would just, like, and that's going to kill you. Like, being in a place of endless despair where it just feels like you are experiencing this world rather than living it. We can't afford to live lives that way. So we got to find and figure out where the hope is. And if not, that has to be a call to generate it.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
Yeah. And I just have to say this because I felt it. And I think that Lindsay and I talk about this a lot. What I heard is like the hope is in the accountability. Like, things are being put into place so that people can be held accountable. And whether that's by way of us using our dollars, whether that's by us getting out and marching in the streets, whether that's by way of us just having a conversation with someone or sending a text message or door knocking or like going to the polls, like, there is a lot more access to accountability than there was before. Mm-hmm. And like, even if that is the step in the right direction that we're in, then like, that's still a significant step forward than we ever were in the past. Just given that we weren't showing up to local elections. We weren't going to, like, we probably participate in the general election and that was probably it. Like, now we in special elections, we doing a lot more. And so I just really do appreciate and respect that. And we genuinely appreciate you, Isaac, for really sharing dropping all these gems, and hope that everyone else has appreciated the time. And please, 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 we want y'all to get in on this conversation. If there are some thoughts that y'all think that you want us to even bring up on another episode, please, please, please comment. Please share this with a friend because we need to be talking about it more. And that's the only way that we'll be able to actually create change in the system.
And Isaac, before we close out, where can people find you? Or I don't know, are you maybe like spearheading like a different organization that you and Jihad might be in together where people could like find you and stuff?
Yeah. I'm really excited about that work. And so Jihad and I serve on a group that we call the Bridge Education Collective. And that group is really focused on, right now, our focus is on retaining and supporting Black and Brown teachers in K-12 classrooms. But our hope is also just to create environments and ecosystems where those teachers and all teachers and all students and parents and families and administrators, we can be in this ecosystem of learning and support together that ultimately gets us to what we want, which is creating well human beings.
Yeah.
So we are, we're connected with that organization. And so you can find us on Instagram at Bridged Collective. And then, I mean, well, me personally, you know, I'm just around. I'll just be out and about.
All right. Well, this has been great. Thank you, Isaac, so much. We appreciate your time. And if you are watching on YouTube, please go ahead and comment. Let us know your thoughts. Hit the subscribe button if you haven't done so already. Go ahead and like, visit our page, and we're going to gear up for the call to action. We are transitioning into the call to action, which is honestly the most important segment of the entire episode. And if you are an avid advocate, ooh, that's a tongue twister, then you understand why this is the most important piece. Like, we have these conversations and we don't want them to just live here in a silo where we're just talking and bouncing off the walls. We want to be able to permeate the culture here. And so we have three different options of things that you can do to actually implement actions for change. And referencing our guest Isaac's statement about agency, everybody has a different role. So we want to make sure we have a variety of options for you so that this conversation doesn't stay here. So the first one, our dearest friend Isaac was an avid documentary watcher. And so he suggested that you go on Hulu and you watch the 6-part docuseries entitled The 1619 Project, which was adapted from New York Times essays written by Pulitzer Prize winning journalist Nicole Hannah Jones, who is also the founding director of the Center for Journalism Democracy at where? Howard University. Okay. Woo! We are always going to find a plug for that. So the series is very story-based and examines the historical events that denied Black Americans the opportunity to build generational wealth. Our guest Isaac says it's heavy, but it's great because it is deeply rooted in storytelling. So when you're consuming it, don't just consume it. Like, you can pause, think about what's coming up for you, and ask yourself, what do I need in this moment to be able to process it? So that's step one, or option one. Option number two, Isaac mentioned something about like school boards and like thinking about education as a system and how the school boards influence that system. I want you to know, before you have kids, right, you don't need to get invested in schools before you, like, just because you have children. There is a way to know what school boards are talking about. If you go to a school district's public page and you search through the public page, there's usually a section that says school board or the board. And when you click that section, you will have an option to look at all the meeting minutes of the school boards. There's also opportunities oftentimes for the general public to have time to have statements about the conversations that are being held at a school board meeting. So I would implore you to just go find a local school district, click on the website, and just look at the school board meeting minutes. Just take a quick glance, just so you know how much power you truly have and how much awareness and knowledge about what is going on locally within your schools.
Yes, yes, yes. Hold them schools accountable, y'all. And as Isaac mentioned, we are a part of an organization called the Bridge Education Collective, and we're two of the four co-founders that are helping educators find solutions to barriers impeding Black success in schools. We currently have two initiatives that I'm happy to talk about. The first being the Teacher Lighthouse series, which is a free opportunity. Yep, I said free. For educators to come and be at a roundtable and kind of discuss different various topics that educators are experiencing. So trying to figure out happy conversations around school policy, trying to talk about the things that we don't talk about, which is educator mental wellness and really taking time for yourself and not just pouring in without having something that's pouring back into you. And then the other event, which we had probably like 2 weeks ago, was our Teachers Lounge. Shout out to one of our co-founders, Natalie, for coming up with the name. And that is just for a space for educators to come and let their hair down and just chill, relax, vibe, network, do what you want to do. This is a space for educators to really just have fun. And we don't really have a lot of spaces like that in the DMV. And I'm sorry, but not in other cities yet. But DMV educators, pull up to the Teachers Lounge. And with that, we love y'all. We appreciate y'all. Peace, love, and light.
Hootie hoo.